Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 18, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm coming to you on recording tonight because I'm off in California, offering a little support and companionship as my wife, Liza Featherstone, promotes her new book, Selling Women Short, which is the story of sex discrimination at Walmart and an overview of the corporate culture at that repulsive enterprise. But I shouldn't say any more because that might look like nepotism or self-dealing or something. But anyway, apologies if you hear some background noises. I'm recording this introduction in my office, and the heat is protesting. Anyway, I've got two interviews up tonight. First, talk with Nomi Prinz about her new book, Other People's Money, a story of corporate greed and corruption in the 1990s, and Wall Street's participation in that. We'll talk to her particularly about the Wall Street angle. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Anatole Levin, a frequent guest on this show. Levin is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the author of a new book called America Right or Wrong, which is a look at American nationalism, and very appropriate right now in the midst of all this post-election thumb-sucking, and I think we will find out that a lot of what looks like it emerged in the brain of Karl Rove has actually got deep roots in American history. So, no news summary tonight because I'm not here. I'm recording this on Friday the 12th, and so I don't really know what's going to happen over the next 6 days. So anyway, let's get started with Nomi Prinz. Nomi is a former investment banker, worked at Bear Stearns for many years, and then last at Goldman Sachs, and she has now left that disreputable business to become a full-time journalist. And she's got a book just out from the New Press called Other People's Money, which recalls her time on Wall Street and examines what happened during the 1990s. So let's listen to Nomi Prinz. Tell us about Goldman Sachs, your former employer. You opened the book with this tale of a Christmas party that was quite something. So tell the tale of the Christmas party.
Well, one of the first events, actually I shouldn't even say the first event, but the first major holiday party event that occurred after I came to Goldman Sachs was this Christmas party that happened at the end of 2000, which was this year, of course, where the market was starting to turn down and there was a lot of potential issues of future cost savings, et cetera. M&A deals weren't coming as fast as they had come. In the midst of all this, we had this managing director's Christmas party, which I opened the book with, as you mentioned, which was at the Jacob Javits Center on the West Side. And it was this situation where the entire concourse area of the center was transformed from the sort of very boring look that it normally has into this sort of fairy tale land look. For the managing directors at Goldman and their spouses, so 800, 900 of us or something. And it was like filled with fake trees and AstroTurf green carpet and fake swans, sort of the sparkly swans that you can think of as being made out of pipe cleaners, and just lots of fairy-like images. And it was all meant to be very sort of festive, this idea of fall and the Nutcracker Suite, Christmas coming on and everything else. And everybody was well dressed up. You know, you had the sort of trophy wives as the partners were very cleavage-oriented, and you had the very small minority of the rest of us managing directors who were female in much more conservative attire, but certainly still festive. And it was a situation where everybody's sort of mingling about, trying to gain favor, and all of a sudden Hank Paulson, who's the CEO, rises from the center of the crowd, like sort of Moses parting the Red Sea, and proceeds to tell us about how times are turning down and how we'll all have to cut corners going forward, and it won't be the same as it's been before, and we shouldn't be thinking about, quote, putting any extensions on our summer Hampton homes this year. After which time we had dinner, Bette Midler sung, and everybody sort of scooted off into the rain for the evening.
This sounds like an appalling spectacle. Is it? It sounds for an institution that likes to think of itself as the pinnacle of Wall Street. It sounds kind of trashy.
Well, and it wasn't even the one that was bad. After I don't have this in the book. I actually had it taken out, but it's the one that keeps reoccurring to me since I started talking about the book, which was before this Christmas party ever happened. It was May or June of the year 2000, and we had a sales conference in New Jersey at this sort of resorty thing by the shore. And it was on a Friday night, and we all had to busload ourselves out there, all the salespeople and the sales managers and the analysts and everyone else. And at 7:30 or 8 a.m. the Saturday morning, I come out of my hotel room, go down to where the auditorium is. We're supposed to be talking about business strategy. And all I hear is, like, Eye of the Tiger sort of pulsating from this auditorium. And then you walk into this auditorium, and there's literally blue and purple lights flashing back and forth across this stage from which some of the executives and managers are about to foretell their strategy for the coming year. And it was really this odd sort of high schoolish situation, and early in the morning, and in New Jersey, which you know also combined the whole issue. But
so, what was it like working at Goldman Sachs, this place that likes to think of itself as the pinnacle of Wall Street?
It's one of these places where if you're in, you're in, and if you have an external opinion, you tend to be well shafted. When I came to Goldman, it had been after I worked at Bear Stearns in London for 7 years, so I was both coming to a different firm, you know, Goldman, and
Bear Stearns has a reputation to be kind of rude and scrappy.
Bear Stearns is rude and scrappy, but it's real. It's like if you want to get your way or your seat on a trading floor or argue a trade or your contribution to it, you take the person on the other side and like you yell at them. It's very sort of in your face and it's very sort of direct. And then you get to Goldman where nothing is direct and everything is by consensus. And I got to New York, I got to Goldman. In the beginning, it was sort of great. I was this managing director. I was like their big female hire. I was running these two groups in their fixed income division, which has been the leading trading division since then in terms of the profitability percentage in the firm. And I was put on all of these cross committees in the firm, marketing committees and these lateral hiring committees, which are ostensibly to get diversity better into the culture of Goldman Sachs. Culture was a big thing there. They referred to themselves as having a culture. I kind of thought of it as more of a cult because it was this idea of trying to be similar to how the senior members and historic members of the firm behaved and how they made decisions, which was all by consensus. There wasn't a whole lot of individual thinking, although we all had to be individually excellent, which was the reason that we were ostensibly in the firm to begin with, but in terms of being individually creative and actually pushing things through without having the buy-off or the opinion of a rather large consensus in most cases was rather unheard of.
Well, let's move on and try to recall the 90s, which people have now largely forgotten. And I guess people do remember Enron and a couple of stories like that, but let's look at it from the Wall Street end. How did the investment banking industry work in that fabled era, and how did they promote the bubble and then really lay the groundwork for the bust that followed?
Well, the biggest thing that was going on in the 90s in banking was banks were merging all over the place, internationally, within the U.S., and it was this idea that there was almost a war, and I mentioned this in the first chapter of the book called Bank Wars, between the banks that really focused on merging and the acquisitions of one company by another and new shares of IPO or publicly traded companies coming in and out and getting substantial fees out of that sort of matchmaking service that they were providing. And then on the other side of the fence, you had sort of the more commercial type of banks like Citigroup and Chase that had a lot of deposits and a lot of lending activities and were sort of bloating their balance sheets, willing and wanting to give to corporate America all this excess money to take a piece off of the merger and acquisition activity that was happening on the investment banking side with companies like Goldman and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch. So you had this sort of war coming in between the types of banks, and the prey that you're really fighting over were the fees that you could make and the business and market share you could get off the corporations that were the clients of both of these institutions, like the Enron and the El Paso and Diogene Reliant type of companies in the energy sector, or like WorldCom and Global Crossing and Quest, PSINet and other companies in the telecom sector, which were the biggest sectors prawn for growth and merging and borrowing and issuing more stock and being pumped up by the very banks that wanted to give them all of these benefits of the money and the advisory work.
Now, there was a time where many functions were supposed to have been separate. Analysts were not supposed to talk to the people at the trading desks. And commercial banking and investment banking were separate pursuits. Those lines all blurred in the 90s. Tell us about that.
Well, back, actually, this goes back to after the 1929 crash, which was ostensibly created also from within the banking system, trying to work with, at that time, public utilities and other corporations in the country in terms of speculation, in terms, again, of lending, in terms of murkying up balance sheets and everything else. And you had this crash that happened, after which there was the New Deal that FDR brought in an act called the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the functionality of a commercial bank and an investment bank so that you couldn't both create companies and create new stock as well as use depositors' money to fund that activity as well as then sell it to those same shareholders or small investors or depositors. The idea is that you had to choose between the two. And over the years, that really became broken down. And specifically in the 90s, and this actually happened before the official breaking down of that Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, which was an act that was almost overwhelmingly unanimously voted in by Congress by both sides of the partisan spectrum. And that basically said banks could buy each other, they could have both activities, and there wouldn't be an official wall of institutions. There'd be just this wall with, you know, between institutions. There would just be a wall within institutions, which in practice doesn't really happen.
And how did this all contribute to the disaster?
So what you had is a situation where banks, it was in their best interest, as they were both merging across the lines of this regulation of Glass-Steagall and other types of components of it that had been broken down, they were becoming bigger, which meant they were being more competitive with each other, which meant it was more important for them to create business, for each individual bank to create business so they could make money and stay competitive in a marketplace that had bigger and fewer players in it. So you take a look at the energy sector and the telecom sector, which I mostly talk about in the book, because what was happening in both of those sectors is they were being deregulated in the mid-90s, in 1996 specifically, which meant that many of those companies, A, didn't have to stay in their own industry. For example, energy companies could create broadband companies, and they didn't. And the energy companies could trade energy without actually having responsibility for distributing it to end users. Telecom companies could trade future potential broadband fiber optic measures with each other over a 15, 20, 25-year period as if they were like long-term mortgages. And you had all these blurring of lines. And it was in the interest of banks to make sure that both of these industries, A, continued to be deregulated, B, continued to trade, C, continued to borrow more money, and D, continued to merge, because all of those activities would create profit for the banks that were pushing them. So you had the profits and the profit really coming from the same place in terms of pushing the idea of these companies having to grow and having to merge and having to acquire and having to expand, getting paid for that, and then needing a place for investors to actually give money into that entire process. So they would have to turn around on the other side and pump the media and pump investors and pump shareholders to buy into this sort of colossal project.
I'm speaking with Nomi Prins, author of the book Other People's Money, just published by the New Press. So we had regulatory changes, legislative changes. So the Glass-Steagall changed the financial industry. The Public Utilities Act was altered. That changed the utilities business. Telecommunications, the infamous Telecommunications Bill of 96. So all these things were fairly recent legislative regulatory changes, led to a big bubble, which then led to a bust from which we're still suffering, the economic fallout. Has there been any kind of consideration of these legal changes, any kinds of rethink, re-regulation, even contemplation of the contribution of the government to the problem?
No. No, there's been actually, not only has there been no rethinking of re-regulation, there's not even been any official voice from the regulatory agencies in Washington or from Congress that have really blamed the logical point of breaking down of the rules that bound how these industries behaved, i.e. banking and energy and telecoms, and having a rethink as to how that might have A, not just contributed to a problem, but B, because it's still in place, could contribute to future problems. And there really hasn't been that kind of conversation. Here and there are some Congress people, like John Dingell of Michigan, who will say, and actually did say to the Federal Reserve that was completely complacent through most of this period, and still is, that, you know, it is bad, for example, for investment banks to get business out of corporations to which they're also tying loans, which is an antitrust violation. And, you know, you get these kinds of responses from Greenspan and various legislators that say, well, we're not aware of that happening, when it's happening every single day. So you do have this real hand-waving of responsibility and any sort of really digging into what causes problems, which to me means if you don't erase the cause, you're never actually fixing the problem.
Well, has there even been any serious analysis, much less action?
It's been astonishing. Even with the deregulation in the energy sector, the response a couple years after the Enron debacle and in the wake of continued and continuing investigations into some of the other companies like El Paso and Reliant and others that were involved in manipulating prices, which they could do because they also don't have to report commodity trading like a bank has to report it, and they still don't. The response of, well, the House was to basically pass an Energy Policy Act that allowed further companies and public utility energy companies to buy each other at the holding company level and sort of more diffuse the responsibility. And it kind of died in the Senate. But given the current makeup of the Senate and the even more, Republican bend that we've had after this election, it's not clear that that won't reawaken and be voted there as well.
Well, to bring up that old Leninist question, what is to be done? What could we do in a better world to prevent a recurrence of that kind of bubble and bust?
First of all, it's not really a recurrence. I mean, there's situations, and I would point first to the financial community and to Wall Street, because the whole service sector there is really what has funded and funneled a lot of the money around that's enabled a lot of what happened to have happened, and also really comes up with the best, most innovative accounting ideas to deflect it all from real transparency. So the first thing you really need to do is fix that. And that's recurring. That's continuing. I mean, you look at Eliot Spitzer's very, very recent fights with the insurance industry, which is an offshoot of financial services, and the mutual fund industry, which is a component of financial services. And it all points to the fact that there's a complete conflict of interest between almost every component of the entire industry. So what really needs to be done before you look at the industries outside in corporate America is a real diving into what's going on in the financial services, beyond merely fining them, beyond merely indicting certain executives, of which there are very, very few, and beyond class action suits, but actually taking a look at differentiating businesses.
And is there anything that's developing now that could be the problem of the future that we should be worried about?
Well, I think what Spitzer has done with the insurance industry, and I mentioned this a bit in the book, is really the tip of the iceberg, because what he's looking at is this idea of companies that are all related to each other. When I say related, I mean like family related. The head of Marsh Mac, who resigned, the CEO, is related to the head of AIG, and the heads of Aon, they're all sort of sit at family tables together, their lineage. So there is an issue there, but beyond sort of sharing what could be called bribery fees for certain types of insurance policy business, the actual industry itself is sitting on tons of structured debt products that the banking industry sold it to get out of some of its positions when the corporate scandals were breaking and when companies like Enron and WorldCom were imploding. So at the moment, not only does the insurance company the companies have this issue of rigging that Spitzer is talking about, but they're also sitting on lots and lots of non-transparent, undisclosed, derivative and structured products that have yet to be accounted for and really fall out of the whole thing. So I think that's going to be a big issue over the next few years.
And especially as interest rates rise, those reveal stresses in the system. Well, what you describe sounds like the ethics of Tony Soprano, only with better suits.
Pretty much. I mean, in the situation of, again, Marsh Mack and AIG and Aon, it's the Sopranos. They have better suits and they arguably are worth more money. Actually, they are worth more money. But yeah, beyond that, it literally is a very conflicted industry.
And that was Nomi Prinz, a former investment banker turned journalist, author of a new book just out from the New Press called Other People's Money. And let's listen to a bit of music that's so inspired those folks from Goldman Sachs, The Eye of the Tiger. And that was The Eye of the Tiger, a piece of rock and roll trash classic performed by Survivor. And beloved of those folks at Goldman Sachs at a sales meeting in New Jersey, Nomi Prinz described in her interview. We'll be back in a moment after this little break. And we're back. This is Doug Henwood, the show behind the news, WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And please do visit that website. Plenty of good stuff there all the time. And you can also pledge on the website if you miss the marathon, miss the fundraiser. You can always make a pledge online any time of day or night at WBAI.org. And now an interview recorded last week with Anatole Levin. Levin is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former journalist, now a think tanker, but uncommonly thoughtful and knowledgeable for a journalist or a think tanker. He is the author of a new book called America, Right or Wrong, just out from Oxford University Press, and it's a look at American nationalism, a very relevant topic these days. A good bit of the explanation for the re-election of George Bush could be found in what follows. So let's listen to Anatole Levin.
Your book seems especially relevant coming, this interview being recorded a week after the presidential election. Any thoughts on that election in the light of the topic of your book?
The re-election of Bush, I'm very sorry to say, did, I think, confirm some of my perceptions or arguments in the book, particularly about the immense strength of conservative religion as a force in America, and the tremendous power of the feeling of embittered alienation that much of this world of the Christian heartland feels, something which not only powers their tremendous participation in politics, but also powers, unfortunately, a tendency to hatred, which I think gives them much of their strength, frankly. The depth of their hatred for what they see as the liberal elites in America, but also for America's critics or enemies abroad, really powers this feeling in the American heartland, which very much helped bring George Bush back to power.
All right, let's get into that in the course of the interview. But first of all, one of the things that's interesting about reading your book in the present moment, it's a very effective reminder that this stuff has a long history, that this just didn't pop up out of the brain of Karl Rove. So you, first of all, lay out a thesis, an American creed, something that Americans believe about themselves and their country. So first, could you give us the précis of what that's all about?
Yes, I structure the book between what I call the American thesis and the American antithesis. The American thesis, this is, by the way, not an original phrase of mine, is based on the values of the American creed, as it's often been called, belief in democracy, in the rule of law, in the Constitution, in human rights, and in various forms of individualism. And this is a creed whose principles are of universal value, and they're also seen by Americans as universalist and optimistic. The feeling is that all mankind can adopt these values, and indeed by doing so can become, in a sense, American, or if people come to America, they can become American. And it's not that these values in themselves are different from those of other Western democracies, but as has often been pointed out, the almost religious intensity with which they're held in America and the way in which they really dominate the entire public political discourse does make them unusual. Richard Hofstadter summed it up very well. He said that it has been America's fate as a nation not to have an ideology, but to be one. And although these principles in themselves are very valuable, they bring with them, as has often been pointed out, certain very great dangers, of which the greatest is a tendency to national messianism, you know, the belief that the American system can be exported to the rest of the world. And not just that, but that it can be exported to the rest of the world without asking the rest of the world, or without asking the people affected. And that kind of attitude obviously played a subsidiary but nonetheless very important role in quite a number of American disasters. People like Fulbright, C. Vann Woodward, Kennan, many great American critics pointed to the role of this kind of messianism in getting America involved in the Vietnam War. Now we've seen it repeat itself in the arguments which helped get America into the Iraq War.
Well, people trying to read the motives of the Iraq War often veer between trying to take something of the Bush administration, some of what the Bush administration says at face value, the passion to democratize the Middle East. At the same time, we see what also could be very cynical motives, lust for oil or lust for imperial or military power. How does this American creed fit into the causes of the war? Is it dominant? Is it a factor? Or is it just a cover for the sleazier stuff?
My own feeling is that most of the people involved, perhaps like most human beings in general, were very good at convincing themselves that they were acting for the sake of a higher morality, even when it seemed pretty obvious to so many outsiders that, you know, many of the real motives, as you've said, were much more cynical and sleazy. I think one of the things about these tremendously powerful myths of the American creed is that they do help people to avoid any kind of real self-examination. Certainly my experience in Washington has been that so many of these people on the right, spouting what by any objective standards, and I'm sure by future historians, will be seen as just the most utterly contradictory rubbish about, you know, democratizing Iraq on the one hand, and yet clapping Ahmed Chalabi on Iraq as, you know, a pro-American strongman. I mean, these were totally manifestly contradictory positions. And yet, I must say, my feeling is that most of the people who were pushing these positions didn't actually see the contradiction. And one reason for that, I think, was the depth of their messianic nationalism.
One of the strange contradictions of American life is that this is a country that's populated by people from all over the place, yet we also seem at the same time extremely provincial. It's a nation of immigrants, but then once you get here, you look only inward and look only outward with contempt, if at all. How do you understand that?
Well, in the book, I compare America to what I call the great civilizational empires of the past, like Rome or China. All the greatest empires have been assimilating empires. They've had to be. That's the only way that they've been able to grow and expand their territory and bring in other people. So none of these great empires were ethnically based. Anybody could become Roman or Chinese by adopting the language, but above all, the civilization. And I think that's what America has become over the years. But, of course, there is one tremendous qualification, which is that all of these great empires, and America too, really saw themselves and see themselves as representing civilization, as being civilization. Barbarians can become civilized, but if they stay barbarian, then they are barbarians and they're not worth talking to or bothering about or studying. They're really only there to be exterminated or at least kept at bay. And I think there's a strong element of that in America. You know, people become Americans. They join this genuinely great American civilization, it must be said. And they really then come to see the rest of the world beyond America's borders simply as alien and even as barbarous and certainly not really worth bothering about, except, of course, to some extent, the countries from which they themselves have come or to which they feel a strong attachment.
I've noticed several times in the book, but also in this conversation, that you will criticize the United States and then point out that there are many great things about this country, or there are also many bad things about other places. I'm sort of curious to descend into the realm of the personal right now. What your relation with or attitude towards the United States is? You're not from here, but you've been here for a while. Do you feel any desire to assimilate yourself to it? Do you feel the perpetual outsider or somewhere in between or what?
I think that I will always be an outsider. I'm just too much of a European. I'm trained as a historian. That leads me to have a very skeptical attitude to national myths in general. And so I couldn't really accept anybody else's national myths. I can't even really accept the national myths of Britain from where I come. But on the other hand, I must say, and I say this very strongly in the book, that the formative influences on my attitude, certainly to international politics and international policy, have been very largely American. Reinhold Niebuhr, George Kennan, William Fulbright, you know, I would see myself as a very much lesser descendant of this intellectual but also this ethical school, which is, of course, profoundly American. And one of the reasons for writing the book was really to act as a kind of advertisement for this tradition and to remind Americans of these great American analysts and critics of American nationalism and of American myths, whose works, I'm afraid, have all too often been forgotten, but certainly they were very little cited in the run-up to the Iraq War, for example, although so much of what they said was absolutely directly relevant to that debate.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, author of the book America, Right or Wrong? An Anatomy of American Nationalism, just published by Oxford University Press.
You describe this tradition of critique. You quote Lewis Hartz in the book from the 1950s saying that America doesn't even pay its critics the compliment of an argument, which is very, very nicely put, but also, I think, very resonant and powerful. What do you mean by that exactly?
One of the other effects, I think, of the American creed, and this has also been pointed out by many great Americans, including Gunnar Myrdal, is that it is so universally accepted that it does bring with it a great degree of conformism in the public debate and in the public discourse. The automatic assumption, and not just in the value of democracy, which we can all agree on, but in the ability of America to spread democracy. The kind of instinctive and automatic deference to words like freedom or liberty, which of course, historically speaking, have been extremely complex concepts, which have changed enormously over time, including in America itself, by the way. And this does mean that it is very difficult in some ways to conduct a searching critique of some aspects of American foreign policy and even domestic politics without finding oneself immediately, you know, boxed as a radical, as a firebrand, as an outsider. I mean, to my immense amusement, I find myself now described not just by right-wing critics, but by sympathetic left-wing critics as a member of the hard left. Well, actually, I mean, as I've said, the formative influences on me have been, on the whole, realistic but ethical conservatives. But then again, of course, in these last elections, most Eisenhower conservatives voted Democrat, so I suppose I'm in good company.
We also, along with the American thesis, there's the American antithesis, which is something less attractive. What do you mean by that?
The American antithesis I see as rooted in this world of the alienated heartland and the white South. And the reason that I call it the antithesis is that so many of the attitudes that go to make it up are, in fact, quite contrary to those underlying, you know, the American civic nationalist thesis. Because American civic nationalism, based on the American creed, is, for example, very optimistic and triumphalist. It sees America as the successful cutting edge of progress, and it believes that this, you know, will go on forever. Whereas this world of the American antithesis, which has been very finely described recently, for example, by Thomas Frank in his book about Kansas, really stems from a deep sense of defeat. I mean, obviously in the white South, but also in this world of Christian conservatism. I mean, these are people who really feel defeated by modern culture. And because of the way in which middle-class incomes and status have stagnated or declined over the past 30 years, there's also a strong degree to which social economic anxiety feeds into this. But then again, as I point out in the book, and as once again great American critics like Richard Hofstadter have pointed out in the past, this is a tradition which in many ways goes back to the very early years of the American Republic. There was always a strong element of alienation in much of the American heartland from the East Coast elites, and a strong feeling that the culture, especially the Christian culture of the heartland, was under attack. So although this has gained a tremendous new force from the 1960s on, it's really based on very, very old American traditions.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the sense of defeat, because the South had its big defeat 150 years ago. Now they have the presidency of a sort. They run Congress. They dominate a good bit of our political life. The Plain States have never really suffered any kind of defeat. Where does this sense of defeat then come from, especially if we go back into the 19th century?
It comes from immigration, partly. You know, this feeling that America was a Protestant nation, threatened by, above all in those years, Catholic immigration. That was something which fed very strongly into the movement for Prohibition, for example, which was to a great extent an anti-Catholic movement directed against the Irish and Germans. But it comes up, I mean, every couple of generations or so, these anxieties. It's very much to do with also the progressive undermining of the old world of the American conservative Protestant countryside in the small towns, the way in which over time these people have, of course, been driven off the land and driven out of small towns and into cities and suburbs. But I think from the 1960s on, you know, what has made this so powerful is that this world experienced a combined set of defeats. Civil rights overturned the old racial order, not so important in the Midwest, but very important in the South. And, I mean, important in the Midwestern cities as well. Then there was defeat in Vietnam, the first defeat in American history. Then there was the anti-patriotism of the left in the 1960s, which seemed to betray fundamental patriotic values. Then, of course, there was the sexual revolution, which one simply cannot underestimate as a real force for stirring up these people, because, you know, when they say that abortion and homosexuality offends their deepest values, they're not making this up, and it isn't a cover for anything else. This world of the Christian conservative heartland does have its own vision of what a society should be, and so much of modern culture goes against this vision. And all these things, I think, came together to produce this this backlash this world of the American antithesis, which, of course, has then spilled over into attitudes to the outside world as well. But what I think makes this so dangerous is that it's combined, as I say, with very strong social economic anxieties about the running out of the American dream for the white American middle classes. But also, it's a kind of perpetually self-sustaining anger, because, of course, since so much of it is directed not actually against Democrats or liberals, but against modern mass culture as such, it can never, in fact, be appeased. They can never be successful, these people, so they will always be angry. They will always be stirred up. And out of anger, of course, comes hatred. And it's that, I think, which makes this world of the backlash so worrying. It's not that their values very often are bad in themselves. I mean, I was raised in a conservative Catholic household myself. But it is the capacity for hatred which is so worrying, and which I think so worries both many American liberals, but also so much of the outside world.
And then this volatile and dangerous combination comes in contact with the very volatile and dangerous environment of the Middle East. Could you talk about how the meeting of this American exceptionalism and the Middle Eastern perpetual crisis, what they mean for each other?
Well, yes, indeed. I must say, by the way, I always avoided this subject until 9/11, when my institute asked me to work on the war on terror, because of my previous work in parts of the Muslim world. But it does seem to me that aspects of the American relationship with Israel are having an extremely bad effect, not just on U.S. policy in the Middle East, but also in stimulating parts of the American chauvinist antithesis. Particularly, I talk in one of my chapters about the way in which the overwhelming criticism of some of Israel's policies in the United Nations, for example, by the overwhelming majority of countries in the world, has stimulated this attitude among many Americans, really of hatred of the outside world, or a feeling once again that the outside world is simply populated by alien savages who hate America, who hate civilization, that America is an embattled island, you know, surrounded, if you like, by a new version of Red Indians. And this has fed, I think, extremely strongly into the contempt, frankly, for international public opinion, which has been shown by the Bush administration, but which actually is demonstrated quite often by a number of leading intellectuals in the Democratic Party as well. It's not that I'm in any way criticizing the relationship with Israel as such, but the nearly unconditional terms of that relationship, the desire to defend Israel in every case and at all costs, I think has had a very, very bad effect. It's also, unfortunately, disabled a large part of what used to be the internationalist intelligentsia in America, people like Paul Berman, who in the past would certainly have seen themselves as internationalists, but now you find adopting positions, you know, of contempt for international public opinion, which really brings them extremely close, in fact, to the hard right.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, author of the book America, Right or Wrong? An Anatomy of American Nationalism, just published by Oxford University Press.
What is the contribution of extreme Christian millenarian views to this attitude towards Israel and its neighbors?
Well, if you look at several members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, including extremely powerful ones on the Republican right, the contribution is very obvious. People like Senator James Inhofe, Tom DeLay, Trent Lott, Dick Armey, all these people, you know, who have explicitly stated their support for Israel's rule over the Palestinian territories, or at least the West Bank, in terms quite explicitly of the belief that these lands were given by God to Israel for all time. Well, of course, if you believe that, and if you say it, then you have ruled out not just negotiation over these territories, but discussion. I mean, clearly, if God has decided this, then there is no point in discussing anything with the Palestinians. But, of course, not just with the Palestinians. There's no point in discussing anything with the Arab or Muslim worlds in general when it comes to this subject. But nor, it must be stressed, is there any point in discussing anything with Tony Blair, America's closest European and indeed in many ways world ally, but who has said again and again, most recently just last week, that it is absolutely critical to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to establish a viable Palestinian state in order to conduct the struggle against terrorism successfully and in order to democratize the Middle East. Well, of course, if a man who has done so much and who has sacrificed so much for the sake of the British alliance with America, if even he is to be, his views are just to be swept away without discussion and, in fact, with contempt, well, of course, the effect on British public opinion, the effect on Blair's position at home, the effect on American alliances is just disastrous. And I'm afraid that Americans very often, because this issue, as we saw in the presidential campaign, is really not adequately discussed within America, Americans just do not realize on the whole how desperately damaging this issue is to their own national interests.
You describe it, towards the beginning of the book, you describe the present, or draw some parallels between the present American state of mind and that of the European nationalism of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, which ended in two world wars and an intervening depression. Are you implying that we're heading for something that catastrophic, or can we pull ourselves back from the brink?
Oh, I think certainly America is not doomed to go in that direction. I say in the book, you know, that I'm not, I don't regard myself as pessimistic, I just regard myself as concerned. The reason why I'm concerned is that in the past, America had a tremendous self-correcting mechanism. You know, there were periods in America of chauvinist hysteria, whether, you know, the anti-immigrant ones in the 19th century, or the anti-German one during the First World War, or McCarthyism. Periods of hysteria which in other countries would have led, in fact, to authoritarian chauvinist rule. And in America, thanks to the tremendous power of the American creed and of American democracy, America always pulled itself back from that, and McCarthy was succeeded by Eisenhower. But there are two, I believe, new elements in America today. The first is, obviously, that America has joined the world in the sense of being physically vulnerable. The American homeland is now at real risk of savage and barbarous attack in a way that it really hasn't been since the great French and Indian raids of the 18th century. And, of course, that could have incalculable effects on the American psyche if, God forbid, incidents like 9/11 are repeated. The other thing that really worries me is what's happened to middle-class incomes over the past 30 years, because a tremendously important factor in American political stability and political civilization over the years has been the fact that, albeit, of course, with terrible slumps and depressions, but over time, the American economy has always been able to generate better jobs, higher incomes for the mass of its population, or at least for its hard-working, respectable population, and of course its white population, it must be said. Now, over the past 30 years, that seems to be no longer the case, but partly because America has also joined the world economically and is therefore subject to pressures from globalization, which was not true before. And if this continues, then I think, you know, the combination of socioeconomic embitterment, religious and cultural embitterment, and, you know, actual attacks on America by America's enemies could in future produce a, you know, a really toxic mixture, which will be a danger not just to America's behavior in the world, but even to American democracy at home. But I think we're a long way from that at present, thank God. It's just that I think we should start worrying about it now in the hope that we will be able to avoid it.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but let's conclude with the any ideas on a possible antidote to that toxic mix or some kind of preemptive approach to prevent it from turning into something fatal.
Well, first, I mean, I think America needs a very new strategy in the Middle East that will be directed towards trying to attract the maximum number of Muslim allies for the battle against al-Qaeda. It is simply crazy to have succeeded in lumping, you know, Ba'ath-style Arab secular nationalism, Iranian Shiism, and al-Qaeda-type Sunni extremism into one homogeneous mass and actually believing this is true. I mean, it's madness. It's like the failure to recognize that the Chinese and Russian communists were at each other's throats in the 1960s. At home, I would say two things. I mean, one is I do believe we need something like a New Deal for the American middle classes, above all when it comes to public health. And finally, I must say I would like to see, as far as possible, some of the heat taken out of these, you know, religious and cultural conflicts. If Americans could rally again behind some common idea of the American family, you know, not an intolerant or repressive idea, but one which stresses, you know, the centrality of the family to American and indeed human civilization, then I think that would be a very good day for America and for the unity and progress of the American people.
And that was Anatole Levin, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and author of a new book called America, Right or Wrong, just out from Oxford University Press. And in the spirit of what Levin was talking about, let's go out with this old song by Randy Newman, Political Science. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. I think I'm away for Thanksgiving, so see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot, and Canada's too cold. South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia. Wanna hurt no kangaroo. We're building all American.